City will come to order. The clerk will note those present. All others have passed away. I'm glad to see that Carl Frederick's here. You know that the other night, for those members of the committee that were here listening to the testimony on 1050, you'll recall that Mr. Mischofsky from Georgia Pacific made certain assertions about the certain agreements that he had made with Mr. Ed Whalen during the Legislative Assembly in 1965 on the Freeway Bill. And Mr. Mischofsky, you know, upon my questioning, assured me that, in fact, that Mr. Whalen had talked to him about the elimination of the circuit court. And I want the committee to note that I talked to Mr. Whalen tonight, and he told me to inform Mr. Mischofsky that he was mistaken. And what Mr. Whalen agreed to eliminate was the self-insured. Now, I don't know how GP's going to take that.
Let the record show that Mr. Whalen has always been...
Mr. Chairman, it's been brought to my attention that we could eliminate all of this hassle on 3323 and some other bills if we would adopt House Bill 2835, which deletes the state of Oregon's responsibility for the enforcement of the federal occupational safety.
Oh, and I figured you'd find that in the back of the book, Mr.
Now, that would...
I told the staff to rip that one out.
That would solve a lot of the problems faced in the state of Oregon. That's what the governor's decided to do with the water quality, and I think...
I'm going to open the hearing on House Bill 2671. This bill has had a previous hearing. Ed, I want you to be brief as far as... Do you have amendments to this?
Yes.
Do you have them? If you'll bring them up, because I would like to get this taken care of. As I understand it, Mr. Capon has talked to me, and everyone that's an interested party in this matter is in agreement with the amendments. Ed, be quick.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Ed Capon, representing Multnomah County. As the chairman suggested, the interested parties, that being Multnomah County and SAFE, have, since your request, discussed the amendments, and they are acceptable to all parties involved. The amendments very briefly do this. They relieve Multnomah County of the obligation of providing a specific list of inmates by name in order for them to come under workman's compensation. We have a static situation where we have the same number of inmates, trustees working on the weekends, roughly 10 per weekend, but they aren't the same 10 trustees. The amendments also require us to provide a roster of those inmates who do serve in case there is a claim. It also states that we shall make a regular payment of contributions based upon the total number of such inmates carried on the roster. It's, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as simple as that. It relieves Multnomah County of the hazard of not having coverage for those trustees that work during the weekends.
Representative Lindquist moved the adoption of the proposed amendments to House Bill 2671 of Multnomah County, dated June 8, 1977. I will go through the amendments briefly as I read them, Mr. Capon, and would you follow to make sure that
sure.
I have them right?
I guess they're probably the same as this that's written.
Yeah. Here,
That
at the end of line 16, with the ending of the sentence, it says inmate, there will be inserted an additional sentence which will say the application shall also state the total number of inmates on the roster for which coverage is requested. The county or city shall notify the fund of any changes in the total number of inmates performing authorized employment. You then go down to line 19, and after the statute citation is 656.794, there's a comma inserted, delete the period, and add the following phrase, and shall require the regular amount of contributions based upon the total number of such inmates carried on the roster. The new 4 on line 20 is you're going to be deleting a large part of that, and the new four will start, the city or county shall maintain separate official membership rosters of inmates performing authorized employment, showing the date each inmate became a member. A certified copy of the official membership roster shall be furnished the fund upon request, period. Only those inmates whose names appear on such list prior to their personal injury by accident are entitled to the benefits of ORS, so forth, setting forth the new statute. I mean, the present statute.
That's correct.
Do I have it correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
You've heard the motion. Is there any further discussion?
I'd like to ask a question.
Yes, go right ahead, Glenn.
You refer to 10 inmates on weekends.
Yes, Representative Otto.
I mean, what about during the week? They covered under a different...
That's a good question. During the week, because there would either be days, there would obviously be days preceding the days they would be working as trustees, we had the opportunity under current law to let SAFE know exactly who was going to work.
Right.
If a guy goes on to work on the weekend and it runs into Saturday, nobody's at home at SAFE, and they might not be covered.
Okay.
I appreciate the question.
Mr. Chairman. Yes, Representative Wells.
What's the assumed wage rate?
Mr. Gill would probably be better equipped to answer that from
That's
you.
That's true. That's true.
Minimum wage?
The assumed wage rate would be the activity in which they're engaged in. They're engaged in sweeping up the floor, there's a rate for that, and whatever that classification might be. The assumed wage rate would be assumed wage of, say, $200 a week, just for the basis of what that generates enough benefits that if he is injured, he would be compensated to the degree that the law provides, almost.
How many people collect?
Not very many.
We've had a pretty good experience in that respect. It's light duty work. Our only fear is not being covered and not paying the appropriate premium to SAFE. It isn't that we have a high risk factor, it's just that we have problems under current law giving notice.
Wall scaling isn't classified.
I don't know the pay rate on that either.
Do you have a permanent total disability?
I can't answer that, Representative Wilhelms.
I think yes.
Chairman?
Yes,
Chairman.
In this language, it says an inmate became a member. What does it become a member of? A roster? Is that proper terminology?
Sir, he's looking at on line 20 where your new sub 4 starts. It says the city or county shall maintain separate official membership rosters of inmates performing authorized employment, showing the date each inmate became a member. And he's asking what the member refers to in that sentence.
I interpret that as meaning became a member of the work team in which coverage should be provided.
And that's a long list, but you only use a part of them from time to time.
That's right, and it's very static. There may be 50 people as trustees who are entitled to work, but it's always 10 or 12 a weekend, and our obligation, if we change the average number to advise SAFE that it isn't 10 a week anymore, it's 12, and SAFE's response would be, okay, your premium thus is so much higher.
I just remain with a little uncertainty as to, it just seemed like the sentence ends there, kind of hanging out in space, just became a member, and I don't know what they call it, but...
Mm-hmm. It's a member of that work team. Yeah. It is a little awkward.
Okay.
If it's clear to others, it's fine with me.
No, Charge, I think you got a good question. Okay. Let me do this. I want to get rid of the bill, but I want it to be in a form that it's understandable. What I'd like to do is to pass the bill out with the amendments, and the staff is going to work it over to make sure that it makes sense, but it's going to pick up the same concept What I will do is I will distribute the committee report to the members, and if you don't like it and want it back, you can do that. If not, it would be my intention to send it to the floor. Is that okay?
Well, I don't see anything wrong with the wording as it is.
I'm going to look at it. I know what George is talking about. There's a couple things. Like, they refer to a roster in here, and I don't see any other place in the statute that it refers to a roster. I don't know if the roster is a proper name.
Mr. Chairman, I think if you get into where they're using inmates, so it's a standard procedure that they have a roster with any situation where they have inmates working like that. In any jail, in any prison, it's a standard procedure there.
I think that's where we lifted the word.
They have to show that. I don't know if it's by federal law or state law or both, but they have to have a roster of where those men are at all times.
That's correct.
Okay. Representative Lindquist had moved for the adoption of these proposed amendments. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, the amendments are adopted. Representative Lindquist moves House Bill 2671 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Lindquist?
Aye.
Representative Otto?
Aye.
Representative Riebel?
Aye.
Representative Rogers?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Wilhelm?
Aye.
Chairperson Coongas?
Aye. Amended House Bill 2671, as amended, will be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Consent calendar granted?
Yes, we're going to put it on the consent calendar.
That takes an awfully long time.
Yeah, that's right. I don't want to do that. I know what
you
have.
You have a House bill and you are killing the bill.
Maybe a point there.
Would you
have that
engrossed? Yes, have it engrossed. Yes. I want you to work on it tomorrow.
Thank you.
Mr. Telfer? Mr. Telfer's gone. Okay, Ed, that takes care of that one.
Just carry that bill. Carry.
Representative Lindquist will carry that bill for Multnomah County.
Most Representative Otto. Multnomah County is always accusing them of not looking at their interests. Would you want to carry that bill for them?
I would be delighted to carry that
bill. I knew you would.
Okay. Would you please inform Mr. Clark that Representative Otto is carrying the cornerstone of his legislative package this session?
Mr. Chairman, Don Particles in the spirit of the slice of him.
Be prepared for the bill to go down.
I'm sure he'll talk it to them.
I'll work the floor.
For defeat. The next bill I'd like to bring up is Senate Bill 1048. Excuse me, that's incorrect. I want to bring up 1049 because I want to get a public hearing on this. As you all know, this is the last bill in the series of the package that we've had that has not had a public hearing. After this, it's my understanding that all the workman's comp bills that we have will have had a public hearing, and we will be able to assemble them to get into a work session on it. Mr. Bob Kennedy?
Chairman, committee members, Bob Kennedy, representing the Oregon AFL-CIO. The Oregon AFL-CIO supports Senate Bill 1049A and Gross. In 1976, as per Mr. Carl Jacobson of the Workman's Compensation Board, there were 33,431 disabling injuries. This is of more than 3 days' duration. And of these, there were 7,249 permanent partial disabilities of varying degrees. National Commission on State Workmen's Compensation Law, pages 68-69 of the 1972 report, and the U.S. Department of Labor report of Interdepartmental Workers' Compensation Task Force, to the President and Congress of the Policy Group dated 1-1977, pages 5-6, agree on wage laws. Quoting from the latter report, quote, although the permanent disability and death cases constitute only about 5% of the workers' compensation claims, they are responsible for about 50% of the benefit payments. with respect to these cases, we find excessive litigation, long delays in payment, high subsequent rates of persons without employment, and little relationship between the benefits awarded and actual wage loss, unquote. I might add that our high unemployment problem in Oregon does not help in this area. And continuing to quote, a major part of the problem is caused by the settlement system, which focuses on terminating the liability of the carriers and employers, either by compromise and release or by lump sum or weeks of benefit arrangement, which attempts to foretell the amount of wage loss that will be sustained by a person with a specific type and degree of impairment. Studies for the task force indicate that such estimates are subject to large error. We in the Oregon AFL-CIO wanted the wage or the loss of wages to be covered in the settlement for permanent partial disabilities as well as impairment. As you can see by this bill, we have compromised by accepting an increase of $15 per degree. Our proposal would have increased workman's compensation premiums 156%. This is very unacceptable to all concerned that are trying to cut the cost of workman's compensation premium. The permanent partial disability amount per degree has not been increased since July 1, 1971, when it went from $55 to $70 per degree. The cost of living increased in the same period by 55%. Some people think that workers are overcompensated in their benefits. This is not true, and as an illustration in the present schedule, for a loss of a hand, you will get $10,500. Now, I ask any one of you who will sell a hand for this amount, even though it would not affect your wages. I doubt if anyone would. The lifetime effect on experiences, normal activities, and personality, to say nothing of the pain and personal experiences for the rest of his or her life, in this case, because of problems with and caused by the appliance that he or she may be fitted with to help them perform a job. In our family, a member experienced this problem until the day he died because of the loss of an arm. With this proposed increase of $15 per degree, a person losing a hand would receive $12,750. This compares to $16,200 in the state of Washington and $21,770 in California. The provision that the second injury fund be used to provide assistance to employers that will hire a worker that has sustained such injuries that there may be a question in the worker's qualifications or abilities to do certain jobs is a good provision. We like this as it may help our workers to be reemployed, and the more this happens should make the employers happy because the more injured workers that can return to gainful employment will reduce the workman's compensation premium. Again, the Oregon AFL-CIO urges a due pass recommendation on Senate Bill 1049 A.M. Gross.
Thank you, Bob. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I was wondering... you compared the person losing a hand in Oregon, $12,750, to $16,200 in Washington, $21,000 in California. At the same time, this is probably relating to a different thing, but we've been told that premiums are lower in the other states. And I was wondering how premiums could be lower, benefits higher.
Well, in the state of Washington, we feel that the two-way system would have been the way to go. However, Senate Bill 376 didn't make it very far this time, and anywhere from 6 to 20% savings. That's the ballpark figures that have been bounced around. So that's how the state of Washington saved some money. Down in California, I think that one of the things that happens down there that's saves them quite a bit of money. They do a lot of compromise and release, and I understand there's courthouse halls are full of deals being cut there, and I just can't help but think the worker usually comes out on the short side of the settlement down there. As in the state of Oregon, we do not have compromise and release.
Then you think that maybe these, like in California, this 21,000 figure
fairly high percentage that might go to attorney fee?
Oh, I don't know about that. I was talking about when you asked the question about the, I was looking at the premium and overall respect with regard to what might affect the premium. And I'm talking about very expensive type of settlements, like on permanent totals, this type of thing. They have very few down there that show on the records, and the reason for that is because of the fact they CNR them. And so possibly some individual that maybe would have had to have $180,000 put in reserve for him if you were here in this state, maybe he might settle down there for $40,000 or $50,000. So you can see that's quite a saving to the system by compromising and releasing on that basis.
Thank you.
Any further questions, Mr. Kennedy?
Thank you, Bob. We're negotiating over here. We're about to make a big compromise. Would you like to hear about it?
No, I wouldn't.
No, you don't.
Mr. Alder Thurman? It's late in the session. Is Allison here tonight, Keith?
I'm in.
Why don't you give those to
My name is Alder Thurman. I'm workers' compensation representative for Boise Cascade Corporation. We're concerned with line 8 on page 5 of the Aid and Growth Center bill. 1049, that deletes reference to pre-existing or subsequent disabilities. If the intent is to restrict the conditions deleted, serious damage will be done to any value the second injury fund will contribute to hiring handicapped persons. The study recently made of the second injury fund in response to a request from Senator Mike Thorne raised several questions on use and funding. One question was, should the second injury plan cover workers who have not suffered a prior job-related injury? It appears that perhaps the writing of amendment to Senate Bill 1049 may have mistakenly accepted the question as a valid recommendation. It was not. The committee stated they were without sufficient information to make a judgment on the questions they raised, and that to do so would obviously require comprehensive analysis. We believe the deleted language on page 5, line 8, should be restored to the bill. Changes to the plan can be carried out under the administrative rules.
So I understand. And that, first of all, let me ask you, that's the only testimony that you have toward the bill, is that one section?
That's the only section I'm interested in at the moment.
And so the other members of the committee understand it completely. Your concern is that under the existing statute, the second injury reserve fund can only be used to compensate employers for those employees who had pre-existing or subsequent disabilities prior to them being hired.
No, that's not it, Chairman Kulongoski. What I'm afraid of is in the way the bill is written now, it refers to the word injury. And injury, in my mind, does not take into consideration a pre-existing condition. And I think that to take care of the worker who comes to the job with a pre-existing condition is mighty important to use a second injury fund for.
No, what I was going to say is that under the present system, isn't that the only purpose for which the second injury reserve fund can be used?
Well, it can
be
used.
The workman must have had
a previous injury or a pre-existing condition, which,
that's right,
which could be a congenital condition, a heart condition, or a spondylolisthesis of the back, or any other condition. That may not be an injury on the job. But I'm saying concerned that maybe the way the bill is presently written could be interpreted that he has to have an on-the-job injury to be compensated under the second injury plan. I want to make sure that the language remains as it is today, that a pre-existing condition is also taken care of.
Okay.
That's all I have on it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Bill.
What you're talking about is someone with some kind of a handicap that may or may not be associated with the work injury.
With the work injury, that's right. He comes to the job. Maybe he comes for a job, and we realize from a pre-employment application or from something in the files medical examination that the fellow has a condition that may be a handicap and that may result in another injury later on. And we think the second injury fund should take care of these particular type of individuals.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Keith?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Keith Wilson, Chairman of the Workman's Compensation Board. Let me comment, first of all, about Mr. Thurman's concern about this bill and say very candidly that this is precisely what the bill does. Over in the bold type on page 4, you'll note that the language in sub 2, in order to encourage the employment of individuals who have incurred compensable injuries that result in permanent disability, which may be a substantial obstacle to employment, the board may provide, etc. Philosophy and the rationale for that wording, Mr. Chairman, is simply this, that the second injury fund is generated by workers' contributions. Who work for salaries or for wages. We feel that the second injury plan is administered by the board and supported from that resource should be limited to industrially injured workers who come to a job with a disability as a result of industrial injury. That if other handicapped people are to be brought into the system, then there must be, and mandatorily must be, some additional funding. And appropriately, that comes from the human resource part of our society, or from the general fund, or from some other source other than the funding is contemplated by the second injury plan. This is the only portion of the bill, Mr. Chairman, that I wish to testify to. This is a new concept of second injury plan in Oregon.
Okay, Keith, you know, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to explain to the committee so that everyone knows exactly under the present law what the second injury reserve fund does, what its limitations are, and what this particular bill does to either expand or whatever you're trying to accomplish as a policy matter.
The second injury plan, of course, is funded by 2 cents per day contributed by all salaried or wage earners, within the state. 1 cent of which goes to directly to the second injury fund, and generates approximately $1.8 million a year in that general area. The second cent of that contribution has been delegated toward the construction of the new Wilsonville Center and the equipment staffing end of it. Now, the need for that second cent will, in the Workman's Compensation Board's view of things, no longer be needed as of July 1st of this year. So we can channel that under the authority of the existing statute into the second injury plan so that it will accumulate 2 cents instead of 1 cent.
What is the current reserve of the second injury reserve fund right now?
The balance?
Yes, sir.
I don't believe I have that figure with me. Because of the construction of the center, it's down, but I don't know.
But since in July, then theoretically you're going to be able to accumulate approximately $3.5 million this coming year.
Yes.
In the second injury reserve fund.
Right.
Okay. What is the amount of average payout to do you have out of the second injury reserve fund? Do you have any figure on that?
We can furnish all these figures.
Could you do that? Yeah. So I understand.
We have that already worked up, and I'm sorry I didn't bring it tonight. We have it. Now,
Bill, go ahead.
Keith, on page 4 this bill, lines 2831 in the deleted
Bill,
language.
Would you let me do this? Let me finish what it does and how it changes, and I'm going to let him get into the specific questions. I'm sorry, Keith. Go ahead.
Well, Oregon has had a second injury plan of one type or another for many, many years, of course. And in our view, the second injury plan that Oregon has had in the past has never functioned well to our satisfaction or really anybody else's satisfaction. We started out by a few years ago reimbursing insurance carriers for costs involved in second injuries. We felt that was not working, so then the legislature at our request changed the law to its present wording, and we reimbursed the employer directly for a percentage of the additional claim costs that he is obliged to pay as a result of knowingly hiring a handicapped person. The problem with the present plan is that it sometimes takes several years for it to mature because the additional premium costs that he encounters may not develop under the rating plan for 3 years down the line. It's an extremely complicated, difficult, and complex program to administer. Representative Lindquist sat on the interim committee, and I do recall that he heard a great deal of criticism about our present plan, and as a result of that criticism, the board was instructed to appoint a second injury study committee and to come back to the legislature at this session and recommend something least advise the legislature the results of the study committee's findings, and that's what we had done there. This is a completely new approach to second injury relief. It places in the hands of our service coordinators an easily explained, easily understood plan of incentive to a prospective employer to hire industrially handicapped people.
Okay, so the requirements for industrially handicapped individuals is still there.
That is in this plan. It hasn't been in the second injury plan up to now, up to this proposal.
What is the present application? Just anyone that has a pre-existing
yes.
disability?
Of any kind, congenital or otherwise.
Okay.
And the reason, as I've stated before, that we recommend that we depart from that is that if that type of people who are admittedly deserving as much as anyone should be assisted, then additional funding should come from other sources. This plan that's encompassed here, of course, leaves a great deal to administrative definition and a plan which is fully placed out and developed by the board for its implementation. But in essence, what it does is place in the hands of our service coordinators program that they can go to any employer and tell him that we will, if he will hire this individual, put him on the payroll and give him a chance, that we will implement or subsidize his wages or salaries for a given period of time in a given percentage. We're also given asking for wide latitude to perhaps even assist that employer, prospective employer, in modifying a workstation so that an industrially handicapped person can function in the workplace. Just by virtue of some sort of modification that we can assist that employer in bringing about. We envision that we'll buy this device, which is simple, easily understood, that we can work quickly with employers to the benefit of injured workers, greatly diminish the downtime of these people, save a great deal of money in reimbursable time loss that's presently being paid, or time loss of every kind, and restore people to working capacity by this device. It's quite a radical departure from anything that's been tried in Oregon, and to my knowledge, and I've studied them all, this plan to me means more in accomplishing the basic philosophy of encouraging the hiring of handicapped people than any plan that I've ever seen. And I've never yet seen a plan that is generally accepted as being a good second injury plan. And I believe this has all the potential of developing into precisely that. If it's enacted.
Bill, now your question.
Okay, I've got a couple. One, first is on page 4, down lines 28 through 31, where the language is deleted, defines a pre-existing disability. How long has that been in the statute, Keith?
Well, I think it's been carried forward for years and years, Representative Rogers.
So it has been a part of the philosophy of the Second Injury Fund for many years, and now we're part of it. All right, now, do we have anything that's going to replace this language where we would have a requirement upon the general fund to allow us to get these people who meet this definition into the employment market?
In other areas, by different types of programs and vocational rehabilitation and things, and in the human resources area, there are programs to assist handicapped people, congenital, or this type of disabilities to assist them in getting work.
Okay. So, now, put it on a practical basis. If someone goes up to Weyerhaeuser and applies for a job, and he meets this definition currently, they may find a job for him because they have this protection afforded by the Second Injury Fund. They don't have to make pre-application to you or anything, as long as they are aware of this condition. Now, if we change this law and this same individual goes up and makes application for the job, what are they going to do with it? Because can they afford to employ him with a congenital condition where they may take the full rap if he's injured?
Well, I don't know. When you speak of Weyerhaeuser and other such
employers, I'm just using them as an example.
Generally, the larger employers in this state look after their own injured workers very well, I think, mm-hmm. generally speaking. They realize they owe an obligation to that worker and are anxious and willing to get him back into production. Mm-hmm. The thrust of this bill really is toward the smaller type of employer. Mm-hmm. I seriously doubt that Weyerhaeuser or Boise Cascade or some of the other larger employers of the state are going to be particularly attracted to this type of an incentive. But the bulk of employment in Oregon is by the medium and smaller type of employers, which I think will be attracted to this.
Well, I must not have phrased my question very well. I'm concerned about the guy who has not been injured but has would meet this definition here in the language that's being deleted of a pre-existing disability. How are we going to get him into the workforce if the employer who would otherwise hire him doesn't have the protection of the second injury fund? What protection does that employer have?
Well, he, by virtue of this bill, people who come to that employer with a congenital condition or a congenital handicap will not derive any benefit from the second injury plan.
And so, therefore, the employer might be very hesitant about hiring that individual.
Unless he can get some incentive or some relief from some other source. If General Fund wishes to contribute to this program and look after congenitally handicapped people, then that should be the source of that incentive rather than the contribution of industrially employed people, in our view.
Keith, as I understand it, what, from your previous testimony, you're saying as a social policy, as a policy decision, since the second injury reserve fund is paid out of the workman's pocket, that he should not have that money being being given to people that have non-industry related disabilities and get the benefit of this job protection when he goes out there and seeks another job.
Yes, that's precisely right.
And you think that the reason that the fund has had so many difficulties in the past is we tried to do too much with it and tried to encompass too many people within the ambit of the Second Injury Reserve Fund.
Yes, sir. And furthermore, it's so complex and always has been so complex that employers or no one else could really understand it.
When you read the old statute, it speaks about three different categories of people: prior accidents, disease, or congenital defect. And you're substituting all three of those for the phrase industrial handicap.
Correct.
Now, what I want to ask you is that reading sub 2, that's a very broad grant of administrative power, because I see no guideline in it other than the general policy statement that you're to provide employment to individuals who have suffered other industry injuries. Now, my concern is the last sentence on 19, 20, 21, and 22. Because what you're basically saying is that we will decide who the Second Injury Reserve Fund payment should be made to, and there is no appeal from our administrative decision. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, what is the policy for that?
Well, it's as long as we feel that the administrative guidelines as adopted ultimately by the board should be plain enough so that the determination really not be any question about the qualification or the entitlement to the relief if the rules are properly drawn and drafted.
Kate, my concern specifically is the fact that you're saying as a policy matter that the Second Injury Reserve Fund will be used for reimbursing those employers who hire employees who have suffered injuries and other industrial accidents.
Yes.
That is a factual question. And I can see an employer and the board getting into a factual dispute of whether the accident was incurred was in another industrial accident. And what you're doing by that last sentence saying, we will make the final judgment on that, and there's no appeal for the employer.
Well, the matter of whether or not the man has ever suffered or has a handicap as a result of a prior industrial injury, I can't conceive of any situation not being a matter of record by virtue of a claim file in this state or any other.
Okay. I understand what you're after. And
I don't, frankly, Mr. Chairman, I don't have any problem if here again we're up against this capricious and arbitrary.
No, that's exactly what it was the same administrative decision that you wanted to be able to make as to vocational rehabilitation, and you're making it now to the second injury reserve fund.
Yes, and I was about to say that if this causes you any concern or alarm, I think we'd be perfectly willing to delete that judicial review.
Keith, here's what I'm thinking of. A workman pays for that. He's putting his money in, and he may be the one that benefits from it. Even though the money goes to the employer, the employee benefits. I see this program more as a benefit to the employee than I ever do the employer on the reimbursement idea.
Oh, no question
but
about it.
The thing is that it's a very critical question to whether he's going to get employed, and I don't want to see the situation that we're getting into serious factual disputes if he should be his employer should be reimbursed so that we give an incentive to him to hire these people. And there's no appeal from your decision, your administrative decision. That's the one thing that concerns me.
As a matter of fact, Mr. Chairman, the matter of entitlement would be settled before you even go into this program, because the thing would be implemented by a three-way contract with the employer, the Workman's Compensation Board, okay, and the employee.
So you would have to identify the employee before he even went to employment.
And what is industrial handicap worth?
What's the process now for hearing an appeal on that decision under the present statute? Does the employer have an appeal?
Yes, he does have, under the Administrative Procedures Act.
Okay. And he can actually get up to the Court of Appeals on a writ of review?
Yes.
Okay. And the proviso on line 5, the thing that Mr. Thurman talked about, that ties in with the bold type on 15 through 22, the language there.
Yes.
And that's going to be a broad grant of administrative powers, and the injuries that you're talking about are those injuries that meet the qualifications enunciated in the policy in subparagraph 2.
Yes.
Okay, and what's the new language in section 4?
Reimbursement on claims of workmen or beneficiaries. Well, it was deliberately broadened so that the form of assistance could be in various areas. We didn't want to limit it in scope. For instance, we may come up with types of payment to assist hiring handicapped people beyond anything that we presently have in mind. So we use the word assistance advisedly. We spoke of wage incentive. We spoke of a modification of workstation, things of that type. But there may be other types of assistance that we can give an employer.
Keith, I'm sorry, I've gotten off. I'm talking about the new sub 4 on line 14 through 19. And let me give you my concern. That's talking about the effect that even though you're changing the policy intent of the retroactive reserve fund, that you're going to continue to require payments out of the retroactive reserve fund for those cases that occurred that were, you said, to those employers from the board had issued an order determining eligibility for such payment prior to the effective date of the 77 Act.
Yes. So grandfathered them out.
No, okay, but those are only for those cases in which the board has issued an order determining eligibility. Now, what about those cases that the employer has hired the person under the present statute, but you haven't issued an order for eligibility? And
And we're referring there to those, this fund is encumbered. The applications that are on file and have been already approved and encumbered prior to the effective date of this act will be honored and paid out of the fund.
Let me ask it another way. Before, even under the present statute, before a workman, an employer can get the benefit of the second injury reserve fund, he must have filed some eligibility document, and it must be on file.
Yes.
And what's all that section saying is you're going to honor all those pre-existing eligibility.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I thought that under the existing law, if the employer had knowledge of this pre-existing condition, that he did not have to notify you and get any kind of a determination, unless an injury to that individual that was related to that disability actually occurred. Is that a misunderstanding on
the matter of knowledge of the employer? Representative Rogers, was a prerequisite to entitlement. In other words, we took the position you can't give an employer incentive to hire somebody if he doesn't even know a handicapped person, if he didn't know going in. So that was the reason for that. On application, if he can show that he did have knowledge and that he did suffer a loss, additional premiums, physical loss to the plant, or something of that nature, then he could qualify under our very complex rules that we've been operating on for these last two or three years.
Okay, now, if someone has someone on board under the existing law, and we change this law, is that, and you don't know anything about it, but the employer does, and an injury occurs to that individual, will they still be covered under the second injury fund?
I doubt it. I don't believe so.
So it is not a true grandfathering in?
No. It's only grandfathering rules that are already established and approved.
I think that an employer may have hired someone in good faith who was disabled under this definition on lines 29. Through 31, the person has not had any problem to this point. Subsequent to the enactment of this law, could have, and the employer stuck.
Possibly so. On the other hand, if he comes to us and says that I can't take the strain anymore of keeping this fellow, I had the protection of the second injury fund, and now it appears I don't. If it means that that worker is going to lose his job, and that the employer is so serious about it, then the board under this provision of this law will be able to work with that employer and the injured handicapped worker to see to it that he is retained, and the advantages of this new concept be extended to that employer.
Where do you get that at?
It's the new section 4, language of new section 4. That would allow them to do that. But that's a decision on your part, and what if the employer is not aware of this change in law? Now, I have to assume some of them are not going to know and are not going to be able to come to you beforehand and make this arrangement or request it.
Well, we've done everything we know how to educate employers.
That's all you can say.
Under our present program, and we haven't gotten the message out. There are certain sector of employers that have taken an interest in it. But if we have a workable plan in the hands of our service coordinators that they can understand and they can explain, we think we can do a far better job of education. Frankly, Representative Rogers, I'm not sure that we've even thought of that particular problem that you raised. I haven't, I know.
Okay. Keith, here's the problem. I'm just thinking, if you have an employee out there that the employer knew he had a pre-existing injury under the present statute, but he doesn't have an order determining eligibility, is still entitled to the payment out of the second injury reserve fund under the present system. Isn't he?
Not under our present plan.
That's because he doesn't have the order.
Well.
Determining eligibility. Let me ask you this. You said in sub 4 on line 17 and 18, to those employers for whom the board has issued an order determining eligibility, that's the retroactive application of this, of the fund. What I'm asking you, is there any cases out there where an employer would be entitled to reimbursement and yet he does not have an order from the board determining eligibility of the
Under this present wording, unless he has an order of eligibility, his application has been approved and his entitlement has been approved but not paid out, those would be protected under this wording.
Okay, but there are people under the present law, forget Section 4, that do not have an order determining eligibility, isn't there?
Yes.
And that's what Representative Rogers asked. And the problem is, and I'm just thinking now, is that if, in fact, an employee pays money to you into a fund, he has a property interest in it. And I'm not sure that you can cut him off.
Well, of course, his entitlement, there's no claim or no entitlement arises under our present plan until a loss has been incurred by that employer in the form of additional second injury.
Okay, but say the guy has a congenital defect, whatever it is, and let's say it's not noticed in 2 years hence, but the employer knew about it before he came to work. Now, he's covered under the present law.
Yes.
And his workman pays in 2 cents a day for 3 or 4 or 5 years. But the way this is written, in 2 years when he has the injury, and it's a compensable injury, and he asks for reimbursement, you're going to deny it.
Right.
And I'm saying to you, I don't know if you can do this.
Well,
because of the fact that that workman has paid money to that fund to cover his injury, he has an interest in it. And you've just cut him off from it.
Yes, my remark then would be the same as I made to Representative Rogers, Representative Krugman.
No,
I don't believe that we even thought of that particular problem.
Okay, Chuck wants to say something. Chuck. He's getting ready.
Chuck has an answer, solution.
First of all, the employee who pays the 2 cents a day in it gets exactly what he's entitled to under the law, and there's nothing taken away from him. It's the employer who recovers from it who pays really nothing into it. Mm-hmm. And so the entitlement is not taken away from the man who's paying the cents per day in that creates the fund. You can grandfather in all those people that have listed handicapped people if you wanted to. However, the board can change, under the present system, without legislation, the rules in applying the relief under second injury anytime they want to. The law goes through a public hearing, as they did before, and they changed it before. So the entitlement can change from time to time as a new procedure for second injury is developed. The uniqueness of this and the great value of this approach is that what's desperately needed in the law is not the reimbursement to the employer after the second injury, but the employment of those that are injured that can't find jobs. And it's difficult to find jobs. The second injury fund, as it's presently constituted, really only benefits a few large employers from the recovery process. This program will utilize the thousands of employers that we have in the state to hire men that have a difficult time finding a job because of industrial injury. It has great, tremendous value in accomplishing some of the very things that we want to under the law. Now, the problem of reimbursing the employers that have hired people because of handicapped conditions in anticipation that there's going to be an injury that might result in a greater disability than normally would occur because of that prior condition,
are probably, honestly, very few and far between. There might be records of them, but I don't think they're hired for that purpose, primarily. They're usually on the payroll already, and the condition occurs, and they make note of it. And they look for that to accomplish some kind of relief.
Okay, Chuck. I understand that.
I don't mean to get into that. But it's a unique concept.
I think it's a good idea, really.
Super idea, and there really is no second injury fund in the United States today that's really accomplishing what...
Chuck, let me ask you just one question. The question of the appeal from the determination of whether the claim is compensable from the second injury reserve fund. Do you think there should be an appeal from that?
Under the way this is constituted, there really doesn't need to be an appeal.
Because he gets the order determining eligibility. He has to have that before you will even consider the claimant.
You're under a different concept now. The eligibility, really, the only eligibility needed is that he's had a disabling injury. And it's noted here that the injury occurred. It's a job injury, and he's disabled. And so the criteria before was very complex. He had to have a second injury. He had to have a pre-existing condition. The second injury had to result in a greater disability than normally would have occurred. And so it was a very complex thing, and there was some room for question. Under this set of circumstances, there really doesn't need to be any kind of appeal because it's a matter of record that he has a disabling injury and it's already been decided.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, though, beginning on line 18, going through 19, in such manner and amount as the board considers appropriate. Now, isn't this second injury fund designed not to cover the basic injury that happened subsequent to an initial one, but the additional portion caused by the...
This
would pick it up in total.
It's just purely a matter of negotiation with a prospective employer. What can we do within our limitations to incur to have you hire this man? Is it 50% of his salary for the first 6 months? Is it 100%? Or what is it? Or do we modify his workstation?
I see.
And the matter of contract will have to be, and the details of contract are going to have to be very carefully worked out because the employer has a very stern responsibility, but the employee also has a responsibility to give it his best shot. So we've got to ensure that those things...
So you're going to negotiate individually in every case.
Yes,
like this. And it will be a before-the-fact negotiation.
Precisely right. Second injury fund is a misnomer under this anymore. It should be the reemployment fund.
I see.
And so the second injury does not need to occur. You can get right to the heart of the problem and not wait around for a second injury fund.
Did you think about renaming that thing while you were in the process?
Yes, but we didn't want to get tangled up in that.
I see. It takes a little while for this to come clear because it's such a change of concept.
It is a change. You see, Representative Rogers, we've always said that the philosophy and the reason for Second Injury Fund was to encourage the hiring of handicapped people. Mm-hmm. That's the reason for Second Injury Fund. This does precisely that. Exactly. The other programs that this state and every other state have toyed around with and wrestled with since year one, none of them have ever really accomplished what we've tried to do. This does exactly what we're trying to do.
Okay. Makes sense.
Thank you. Mr. Kalinowski, for the other people here, the bills that I'm going to put turn to work session right after this are 2136, 301, and 302, and I'm going to try and take action on them. The other bills, it appears that I will not get to because of the fact the committee has a rule that I'm going to close down at 10 o'clock. So, Jack, if you have the amendments, Jack, the bills can be set for another work session. If you'll give us the amendments and
brief so I can get to these other bills. I'll set you up again and come and testify, but I want the amendments to the bill that you have.
Mr. Chairman, the amendments have been presented. Your clerk has engrossed them. They're available, and I see they're being distributed.
Let me ask you, Jack.
For the record, my name is Jack Kellanoff.
Do you have any objections to the bill as it's presently written with the addition of your amendments? Do your amendments change the printed bill as far as the new amendments to it?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And since you're going to be holding another hearing on this bill, I will not discuss the addition, the new sections 5 and 6, I believe it is, that are proposed by our amendments. I think that's something that will take a considerable amount of discussion. But for the sake of time tonight, Mr. Chairman, I would like to restrict my comments to the bill as it has been discussed by the previous witnesses, especially addressing, if you will, the second injury fund. I find that, respectfully, I must take issue with the conclusions that Mr. Wilson and Mr. Gill have given the committee. Mr. Wilson, as I heard him, said that this concept that is in subsection 2 of section 2 of the bill is universally accepted. Mr. Chairman, I've talked to representatives of several employer associations, employer groups, asking if the concept as described by your previous witness would be of any advantage at all in hiring handicapped people, and the answer was no, it would not. I can specifically tell you in our industry, in the construction industry, we would not consider any kind of reimbursement as a part of salaries to hire someone who has been handicapped. It would not serve as an incentive. The agriculture people, in their concerns about the cost of workman's compensation, have been advised that, I believe it was last year, there was one permanent total disability that was the result of an occupational accident in the agriculture industry, in which the reserve that the state accident insurance fund set aside was over $600,000 for one injury, an injury that resulted in a permanent total disability. If you offer a construction contractor $500, $1,000, or $5,000 to risk that kind of liability, it is not going to be received. It will not be incentive in that case to hire a handicapped person. In those instances where we have exclusive hiring halls, such as most of the contractors that I represent, we simply, at the present time, cannot find out whether the employer or the employee that is dispatched to us by the labor union with whom we have a contract has any kind of a pre-existing disability, whether it be congenital, whether it be non-occupationally related, or whether it is occupationally related. We simply cannot find that out. Consequently, in our industry, as well as many others, incidentally, the current second injury fund does not work. We cannot find out if there is any kind of pre-existing disability. Hence, it is just simply not possible unless that disability is extremely conspicuous, we cannot find out in advance that a disability exists. I would also, Mr. Chairman, have to take issue with the conclusion that is reached in the present subsection 2, that the second injury fund should be restricted to only those who have suffered occupational injuries. Every workman who labors in the state of Oregon contributes to the second injury fund. There are a great many workers in this state who have pre-existing disabilities, any one of the three conditions that I mentioned before. An epileptic may be working and contributing his money. To deny him the opportunity to have some kind of benefits to encourage employment because he is an epileptic seems to me to be highly discriminatory. The whole purpose of the Second Injury Fund is to encourage the hiring of the handicapped, and it should be made to work that way. Whether or not that handicap dates from the birth of the individual, something that was incurred through some other kind of non-occupational injury, or as a result of some kind of occupational injury. If you're talking simply about equity, I do not understand how anyone can support taking money, albeit a somewhat small amount, from someone who has a pre-existing non-occupational disability and then denying him the benefits that should accrue to him through this fund. Our amendment, Mr. Chairman, I think, and we think, would do an awful lot more towards hiring the handicapped. What we're suggesting here is that you, in essence, to a great degree, remove the financial liability that employers risk when they hire anyone who has any kind of pre-existing disability by utilizing the second injury fund to pay medical costs that occur when a second injury does result, and it is found that that individual who has suffered this second injury does have a pre-existing disability. It seems to me, Mr. Chairman, that if the second injury fund would be used for this purpose, and if there is no requirement that that employer have knowledge of any pre-existing disability, you're going to remove the fear that employers have from hiring somebody who is handicapped, at least to a greater degree than ever before. I would just perhaps remind the committee of some very important but a very brief statistic. It seems like every year in Oregon we have 36,000 disabling injuries, 6,000 of which result in some kind of permanent disability. There's some 30,000 injuries that occur every year in Oregon that do not result in permanent disability. I guess what I'm saying is that the possibility of hiring a handicapped person and then using the second injury fund to pay his medical costs will accrue in a great many cases to those who do not have permanent disabilities resulting. That way, I think you're going to have a greater amount of encouragement to employers to hire handicapped people. the program as outlined by Mr. Wilson simply will not be any kind of encouragement.
Jack, I don't want to get into a discussion with you tonight on it, but so I can just look at it. I understand what you've done with your amendments as to the printed bill, but the addition of sections 5, what you have done is you've added the amendments to 656, 202, 212, and 268. They have nothing to do with the second injury reserve fund, do they?
Well, Senate Bill 1049 relates to more than one subject, permanent partial disabilities.
No, I understand that, but...
You're right, Mr. Chairman.
It doesn't have anything to do with the general tenor of 1049, which is the second injury reserve fund. Like, 268, Jack, is in 1050. I mean, if you want to play around with that particular provision, that statute is in 1050, being amended.
This was proposed as an amendment to this bill because Senate Bill 1049 does increase the amount of benefits payable for permanent partial disability, and this the new language that we're proposing would...
But Jack, you're screwing around with 268 again, which is the determination of when a person's cut off a temporary total, which is exactly what we've been fighting in 2237, which we put out, which is the bill we went through already.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
no, I'm not saying you can't do that. I'm just saying, but
what
I'm trying to do administratively, that's what you've done.
I understand.
Is that correct? Because I want to know if, in fact, because I've read your amendment, and I don't see what it's doing. We've acknowledged that it doesn't do anything with the second injury reserve fund. You're after the permanent partial award in the front of the bill that we're talking about, and that's what the new amendments address.
Yes.
Okay. So I understand that.
The manner in which permanent partial disability determinations are made.
Thank you, Jack. I'm going to set this up for another hearing, and we'll have you back again and go through all the amendments with that. I'm going to close the hearing on 1048. That's all that's testified. I'd like to very briefly bring up the following bills.
You closed the hearing on 1048.
Yeah, 1049. 1048 and 1050, I'm not going to get to them. Carl, Mr. Thurman, I'm going to get these bills out tonight because they're Senate bills. The first one is A. and Gross Senate Bill 301. If you recall, this is that bill that had to do with third-party lawsuits in regards to indemnification agreements. If I could tell you what the problem was, that remember on the floor, I had it sent back to the committee.
Yes, sir.
Jack, is Mr. Fransky here? When did he leave? No, that's okay. I just wanted to let him know I've got the bill up, and I'm going to show him the amendments to let him know. If I wasn't going to have him testify. If he wants to come in and listen to this, he can. 301. He wrote me a letter on it. If you look at lines 17 through 19, the problem is that it says, except as provided in paragraph B of this subsection, all agreements or warranties contrary to the provisions of paragraph A of this section are void. There's a serious question of whether that's unconstitutional in that it is voiding current existing contracts, which is a constitutional prohibition against. And in those agreements that have already been entered into, I'm not convinced that, but I think it's a serious allegation that I do not believe the legislature can pass a statute voiding those contracts that are already presently existing. And what the proposed amendment that's going to be to you is that it's going to basically say that paragraph C of subsection 1 of 656.018 applies to agreements or warranties entered into are renewed after the effective date of this act. Carl, did you understand that? Have you got the amendment? Yeah, that's exactly what I'm going to do. I don't know if I like the way it's said. That's right.
Yeah.
What are they talking about?
Okay, have you got the bill?
Yeah.
Here we go. Representative Lindquist moves the adoption of the committee's proposed amendments to A. Gross Senate Bill 301, which appear that on line number 6, section 2, there will be inserted a sub 1, and then... Yeah, you, have you got it, Gary, the last page?
I don't have an A in Gross 301.
SB 301?
I got a 301, but I don't have an A in Gross 301. Oh,
yeah.
You've had trouble before.
On line 6, after the word actions, will be inserted for contribution or indemnity. Be inserted, so that section 1 will read, this act governs all actions for contribution or indemnity filed subsequent to its effective date. And there will be a number, sub 2, which will say paragraph C of subsection 1 of ORS 656-018 applies to agreements or warranties entered into or renewed after the effective date of this act.
You get one
of those? Yeah, well, that's because Representative Rogers over there.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, here's one extra one.
Mm-hmm.
all agreements or warranties contrary to provisions of Section A of this section and entered into or renewed Now, I'm trying to avoid going to a new section in the bill. It's sub C, it's just, it isn't a...
It's funny.
Except
we're
for...
We're not enforceable after the date of convention.
No, except...
Are we in overtime after 10?
We're getting very close to overtime.
Yeah, again. Jack, is Fransky out there? Did he leave? Okay. Does the committee, the problem with it is that sub C is much too broad, and it's, you need to make a perspective so that those agreements that the parties have currently entered into are still valid, of which they have contracts for. And what we've got to do is to draft an amendment to say, except...
I'd move the staff do that.
No, Council, Christ, I hate to hold on to this thing for another day. I don't like the amendment that we've got proposed.
I was going to ask you, what's your objection to Section 2 amendment?
You mean the new... Jack, Carl.
It doesn't.
No, it clearly doesn't. The problem is just a lot of wording that doesn't need to be there if, in fact, that sub C was worded properly.
But she used the words not in existence in the effective date or void.
Yeah. Okay.
What do we do about attorneys?
Well,
three or four of them, you know, you'd like to find out, huh?
Yeah. Okay, so what you're saying, let me read it again to you. Except as provided in paragraph B of this subsection, all agreements or warranties contrary to the provisions of subsection B of this subsection and not in existence on the effective date of this act are void.
Okay, I'll put it.
It wasn't my idea.
Oh, no, I figured there must be a reason for it. I was just wondering what it is.
I'm going to close the hearing to Senate Bill 301. It'll be the first order of business on Wednesday's agenda. The amendment will be proposed at that time, and I will have it in. The next bill I'd like to bring up very quickly is A. Gross, Senate Bill 302. We had a public hearing on this, and if I recall, there was no contrary testimony to the bill. There are no amendments to it, to my understanding.
We had a hearing on it?
Mr. Kalinowski is for the bill. Mr. Wilson is for the bill. They have no amendments to it.
What's this, Reg? Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I think the Representative Rogers raised a point here some time ago, and I would concur. And on page 2, line 11 and 12, when the workman incurs a serious disabling compensable injury, the report shall be made within 30 days of the date of injury. And if I remember correctly, Representative Rogers' question was, why so long? And I guess that would be my question, too. To me, 10 days would be, without hearing any testimony in opposition to it or for it, to me, 10 days would be more reasonable than 30.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Bill.
I discussed this thing with Pete Fleischner from the Hospital Association, and he felt that if there was some provision made whereby the hospital could notify someone either locally or if there was a toll-free line, they can make this report at the time of the admittance to the hospital because they're processing paperwork at that time. He didn't look for it with great relish, but he agreed that that was probably the appropriate, that was probably a very appropriate time to do this. And I didn't realize we were going to come up on this thing tonight. And so I don't have any amendments prepared for this, but this, we talked about this. We talked about it last session, talked about this session, about getting some kind of an immediate action. And I just can't see where 30 days is that immediate. Now, I was talking with a young woman tonight on the telephone whose husband is in the hospital as a result of an injury. And there's just a lot of things that they don't know yet. He's been in the hospital, a month and a half, and still in the hospital, and now the Workman's Comp Board is involved in it, SAFE's involved in it, but it didn't happen as quickly as it should have. And
Bill, why don't I do this? Why doesn't Anita see you tomorrow?
Okay.
And you two talk. And I want somebody from the board to talk with them also as to the 30-day requirement provision in that so that we don't do anything that's going to scuttle the whole program. So that on Wednesday, that bill will be brought up for a work session again, and if there's any amendments to it, it will be put out at that time.
Okay.
Okay.
Be glad to.
I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 302. I'd like to move very quickly to House Bill 2136, and this is the last one this evening. Now, if I could to you, this is the bill that had to do with the vacation and holiday pay.
Yeah.
The agreement that we have from all the parties is we're going to leave the vacation pay alone, and there's going to be no changes in the existing law on that. We're going to attack the problem of the holiday pay. Libby? It's been so long since you've been before the committee, and we picked a good night for you to do it.
I back in the 2nd of February, she was going to give us amendments or something.
Lily, why don't you just state your name and tell me what the amendments are very quickly. A, B, and...
Libby Leonard, Supervisor Benefits with the Employment Division. You have before you two proposed amendments, marked A and B. They're identical except that A has an extra sentence in the holiday pay which would, if the payment for the holiday is not made within 30 days following the end of the week in which the holiday falls, then it would not be deducted. And the reason that we suggested this was we have had trouble at times when we were deducting holiday pay with the situation where a company would perhaps go down with a number of people. One I'm thinking of had over 300 first part of January, and January 1st was a holiday. Those people would not get their holiday pay for January 1st until they went back to work. And the one I'm thinking of, we determined at first that it should be deducted, so we deducted it from that week. And then along came the rumors, and verified by the employer, they were never going to reopen. So therefore, we reimbursed everybody for what we had deducted, and on July 1st, they reopened, and we had to go back and set up overpayments. And what we'd like to do is say after 30 days, which is a normal pay period, if a holiday pay hasn't been received, then we would disregard it as a deductible earnings. The other amendment, B, does not have that sentence in it.
Okay. Libby, you have explained to them why that additional sentence is in there.
Yes.
Do the committee members understand? I had an arbitration not too long ago over that very idea, and that is that in the construction industry, they say that if a person is going, let's say, where it's really noticeable is at Thanksgiving. They'll say if you're going to get paid for Thanksgiving as a holiday, you generally must work the last working day before the holiday and so forth. What happens in the construction industry, these guys may work, our contract says you have to work 15 days prior to the holiday. And you would get that in, but then they would have the close down and you'd never get your holiday pay because you didn't fall within the ambit of the end of the thing until after you got back to work again, and it may be 4 or 5 months.
That's right.
And this provision would say that if that occurred, they would have to, you would only get disqualified, Amendment A, if in fact that you got paid within the 30-day period preceding the holiday, following the holiday.
Yes.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Let me just to get it up, the chair would entertain a motion for the adoption of the concept of the last sentence in amendment number A as distinguished from B. You've heard the motion. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection? Okay, the concept in amendment A is adopted. I'm going to drop out amendment B. Now, for the committee's attention, I know this is my fault, and I apologize because I didn't tell you. You've incorporated most of the present language on page 2 of the bill. Did you not?
Yes.
Okay. I don't want to mess with that. And all I want to do is just keep, I understand your position, but I want to keep that as the existing law the way it is. And all I want to do is handle the problem of the holiday in this bill. so that I don't get in any other hassle about any other issue in this bill other than holiday pay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So what the staff is going to do is they're going to draft the amendments to put page 2 back to the present statute. We're going to put all the way over to page 3 back to the present statute. And the change will now occur on page 3 after 7, delete lines 33 and 34. And what we're basically going to be doing is inserting the new paragraph that you have. Is that correct?
Okay.
And then we're going to, on page 4, delete lines 1 and 2. And then we're going to restore lines 3 through 9, restore the deleted language in line 11. Okay. And so basically what we're doing is we're just, at that particular point, just putting the statute back in its present form.
That's right.
That's it completely.
Right.
Representative Lindquist moves for the adoption of Amendment A with the understanding that the current bill is going to be put back in the terminology of the present statute, and what we're going to add is the new Amendment 7.
That's what I said, yeah.
Is that it? Now, you've heard the amendment. Is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman,
yeah. Bill.
Does this resolve the problem that was brought to us by Tektronix and Omart?
They're back there and they're in agreement with this particular proposal to handle it this way. Yeah, all of 7 goes in. Basically, all we're going to do is, if you were looking at the present law, it's going to be a new 7.
That's exactly what you're doing.
Would you like to split this amendment into some component parts so I can vote against part of the amendment and for part of it, or do you have your 4 votes?
Which is that, Bill?
Well, I've got no problem with this on page 3 after 7 going on through there, but I think that the Employment Division has made a pretty good point for some of these changes that are contained on page 2.
Okay.
Earlier.
Bill, the problem is, as I can tell you, you will seriously jeopardize the bill if you do that. And the most important thing for them is to get the holiday thing cleared up. And that's why I want to do it in a clean bill with just that issue, so that no other issue is being fought out in this thing and the whole thing goes down. Any further discussion?
Did we move for the adoption of the amendment?
This is what it is. Okay. Have we adopted that? Okay. Is there any objection to the adoption of the amendment?
That part of it, no.
Okay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Lindquist moves that House Bill 2136, as amended, be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection? Clerk, call the roll. I'm sorry. It's getting late. Mm-hmm.
Representative Lindquist?
Aye.
Representative Otto?
Aye.
Representative Riebel?
Aye.
Representative Rogers?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Wilhelm?
Aye.
Chairperson Colgatta?
Aye. Amended House Bill 2136 is sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Do you want that engrossed?
What?
You want
yes,
that
I want it engrossed.
Fierce and all bad, wouldn't
I'm sure not going to carry the damn thing.
You want to carry, Phil?
No.
I think he said he wanted to carry.
Gary, why don't you carry that?
All right.
Gary, all it's going to do is handle the holiday pay. It's the only thing it's going to handle, holiday pay.
I believe you.
That was my fault for not informing you that. I was just under the assumption that we were only going to handle that issue. I know what you want. I'm not going to fight that out. I know, you tried. It was a very...
Libby, next time, we'll get it.
Is that it, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, that's all. I appreciate you waiting 15 minutes with me, and hearing is adjourned.